A Texas-style abortion law might soon be in the works here in Florida. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. State Representative Webster Barnaby filed the bill in committee. Could the restrictive law come to the Sunshine State? And what might happen to the Texas law if it makes it back to the U.S. Supreme Court? Also, a new art exhibit looks at the numerous crises of our times through the lens of some of our childhood fables, like Alice in Wonderland. And finally, Sunfest won't be back fully until 2022 because of the pandemic. We'll learn about a small series of concerts happening now that will lead up to next year's event. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Just weeks after the Texas legislature passed among the most restrictive abortion laws in the country, Florida followed with a similar proposal. Yesterday, State Representative Webster Barnaby filed a bill in committee. It allows private citizens to file lawsuits if they believe an individual is aiding in an abortion of a pregnancy that's more than 6 weeks in progress. The legislative session is set to begin in January, and this is likely to be among the hotly contested topics. Meanwhile, the Texas abortion law is facing its first legal challenge after a private practice performed an abortion past the 6 weeks granted by the state. Mary Ziegler is a law professor at Florida State University and author of Abortion and the Law in America. She specializes in the legal history of reproduction, the family, sexuality, and the Constitution. Ms. Ziegler, thank you so much for the time. What are the fundamental differences between Florida's proposal, this new proposal that was just put in committee yesterday, and the law that exists in Texas?
Well, Texas's law and Florida's law are similar in many ways. The most significant being this metric of, or this private enforcement bill, in the sense that most abortion restrictions you may have heard of before criminalize certain abortions. Florida's bill, which I think is patterned on Texas's bill, instead outsources enforcement to private citizens. So that's designed, I think, in Florida as in Texas, to avoid the possibility of a constitutional challenge in court.
Like any bill, you know, it's seldom, I mean, I don't think you've ever seen a bill go all the way through committee and then, of course, through the House and the Senate without changes. So we'd expect fundamental changes to the bill over the months of the legislative session. Do we expect these changes to the bill as the Texas law faces legal scrutiny?
Yeah, we might. And I mean, it's sort of been a little bit unclear where the Florida GOP is going to be on this bill. Initially, when the Supreme Court let Texas's law go into effect, Governor DeSantis and key Republicans in the legislature were very positive about this kind of strategy. Since then, the governor's spokespeople have been much more keeping their cards close to the vest on this. It's not clear that Governor DeSantis is supporting this bill, in part because I think we've seen some popular backlash to the idea of civil enforcement, which, you know, can kind of almost create a bounty scheme and incentivize neighbors to report on one another. And also because we've seen that bills like this can have unpredictable consequences. When people can bring private lawsuits, it's not always clear that they're bringing lawsuits for reasons that conservative lawmakers in Florida may approve of.
Since Roe v. Wade, advocates for restricting access to abortion have pursued a variety of legal challenges to stop it. What are some of the different ways that you've seen over the decades that have come close to what Texas's law has been able to do? I mean, granted, it's still new, and we have to see what's going to happen.
Well, there really hasn't been anything since the Roe decision that has effectively eliminated, you know, 85 to 90% of abortions in a state the way that Texas's SB 8 has done. And that would be particularly consequential in Florida because Florida has a relatively high abortion rate has a relatively high raw number of abortions, and that's particularly true because Florida is the outlier in a region where states already restrict access to abortion considerably. Most of the bills you would have seen before were more incremental in lots of senses, either in the sense that they eliminated abortion access late in pregnancy, or they introduced various hurdles like the mandating the involvement of parents, waiting periods, requiring that patients hear certain information before getting an abortion, much less direct than eliminating most abortions in the state.
And yet, as you said, Florida is the outlier. Are you comparing it to other southern states?
Yes, yeah, it's a regional outlier. So historically, and that's there are several reasons for that, some of them tied to the Florida Supreme Court and the Florida Constitution, some of them tied to the fact that Florida is, of course, the sort of quintessential swing state and doesn't necessarily have as homogeneously a conservative or pro-life or anti-abortion population as some states neighboring it in the South.
So with the Texas law, it basically says anyone can file a suit against the person who's performing an abortion. What exactly are they suing for?
Well, they are suing to get money. I mean,
it's just money.
Well, one of the things that's unusual that Florida is trying to replicate is that they don't have to have suffered any kind of injury, right? So usually in Florida to file a lawsuit, you have to show that, you know, somebody hurt you and that a court can compensate you somehow, right? You have to have skin in the game. These kinds of bills, like the one Texas had created, don't require that anymore. So you can bring a lawsuit even if you have nothing to do with anything, as long as someone performs an abortion within the period that the statute disallows.
And we've seen this, all right? So there is a doctor in Texas, Dr. Alan Braid from San Antonio. He claimed to have provided an abortion past the 6 weeks, and he said he did it intentionally because he wanted to provoke a legal challenge to the law. I'm going to ask you about that, but first, because we're talking about what you could sue for, there are already two lawsuits filed against him. And one of them is a man who actually even said that he doesn't have strong feelings about the issue of abortion. He admitted he just wants the money. So how do we expect the courts to receive these kind of lawsuits where you just have someone who, again, as you pointed out, maybe they weren't hurt by it. There was no damage against them. They will actually admit and say, no, I'm just out for the money.
Yeah, I mean, one of the gentlemen filing one of these suits is actually a felon who's currently under house arrest, who pretty much explained that he just wants to collect, you know, $10,000 at a minimum. He's actually asking for $100,000. I think first of all, once there's an actual person being sued in court, it's much more likely that we're going to have a successful constitutional challenge, unless or until the Supreme Court overrules Roe v. Wade, because the challenge before was not that these laws are constitutional. It was that it was not clear who should be getting sued. And it was unclear who's going to be enforcing the law. Obviously, if Dr. Braid is in court defending himself, there's going to be a specific judge listening to that suit, enforcing a damage award. And so he's going to be much better able to raise a constitutional challenge to the law. And that would be true in Florida as well. So one thing I wonder, if you are a Republican in Florida, if you really want to go to the trouble of doing this when the Supreme Court may be reconsidering Roe v. Wade by the summer of 2022, and when you're quite likely to see doctors like Dr. Braid come out of the woodwork to mount successful challenges to the law. Finally, I think what we've seen in Dr. Braid's case is that right to lifers or abortion opponents are kind of losing control of the script. I mean, the point was to advance a sort of anti-abortion or pro-life message. And obviously, you know, felons seeking to collect checks are not really in keeping with that messaging strategy.
I'm talking with Mary Ziegler, law professor at Florida State University, also the author of Abortion and the Law in America. Florida has introduced its own legislation that allows citizens to file lawsuits against individuals aiding in an abortion with a person who is more than 6 weeks pregnant. You can find more information, by the way, about that story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Yeah, coming back, Professor Ziegler, to this Dr. Braid in San Antonio, he did this on purpose, he said, because he wanted to provoke a legal challenge. What is he trying to do?
So what stopped the challenge to Texas's law before is this principle called sovereign immunity, which limits when you can sue your state government or any state government. The one exception to this general rule is that you can sue a state official who's enforcing an unconstitutional law. The problem was that Texas and Florida are both claiming that they're not going to do any enforcement. It's just going to be private citizens. And until there was a real lawsuit in the real world, there was no way of really disproving that. So the Supreme Court looked at this and said, well, it's not clear you know who to sue. It's not clear there's anyone you can sue, so you can't be in federal court. What Dr. Braid is doing is essentially saying, look, I violated the law, come get me. And of course, there's some people who want to collect a check who did just that. And now it's going to be quite clear who's enforcing the law. And once that's true, it'll be much easier to raise the kind of constitutional challenge that hasn't been successful so far.
And I mean, look, we see these two lawsuits. Are you surprised by that? I mean, again, just people wanting to collect a check, that there aren't more?
I mean, I think the only reason there aren't more, frankly, is because once Texas's law has gone into effect, a lot of people in the anti-abortion or right to life movement have encouraged people not to bring lawsuits, which just goes to show you why it might not be the best idea strategically for Republicans in Florida to pass this bill if a version of it in Texas is that disruptive to people in the anti-abortion movement in Texas, right? So there's been a kind of concerted campaign to say, if people like Dr. Braid are announcing that they're violating the law, they're doing that because they think it's to the advantage of supporters of abortion rights. So I think we would expect to see something similar happen in Florida if this law does in fact become part of our law.
I think it's just fascinating what you're saying, and that, you know, again, that both sides of this debate for so many years now are losing the control of the narrative because of this law. It's now getting flipped. And again, you're putting in the hands of just people and not lawmakers. This idea, by the way, of filing lawsuits is not new. This goes, there's a story back in Texas, back in the 1990s, and it was a gentleman, Mark Crutcher. What did he do? What was he trying to do?
So there's a long history of trying to use civil suits to shut down abortion. So Mr. Crutcher's argument was essentially, if the Supreme Court won't get rid of abortion rights, we can still make it impossible for abortion providers to stay in business. So he handed out a manual about how to bring medical malpractice suits against abortion providers and make their insurance costs prohibitively high. And to kind of discredit them so that more doctors wouldn't want to become abortion providers. And he was, surprisingly, in Texas. And a version of this then took place later when Texas began creating so-called sanctuary cities for the unborn. We begin to see these in Florida as well, in Santa Rosa County and the Panhandle. The basic premise was that these small towns wanted to ban abortion, but they didn't want to get sued and have to pay attorney's fees. So their strategy, again, was to outsource enforcement to private citizens, which we now see happening at the state level in Texas and maybe in Florida as well.
The U.S. Supreme Court didn't take any action on this law. What does that mean?
In the short term, we don't really know, right? Because on the Texas's law was designed to avoid a confrontation with Roe v. Wade. So we can't say for sure that the Supreme Court will relish a confrontation with Roe v. Wade when it takes a major Mississippi abortion case, which it's going to hear this December. On the other hand, I mean, the court let go into effect a law that effectively eliminated abortion in Texas. It's hard to imagine the court would have done that with, say, the right to freedom of religion or the right to vote. So it suggests that the court doesn't view abortion as the same kind of protected right that it does other constitutional rights, which, of course, doesn't bode well for the fate of Roe v. Wade later this year.
And yeah, as you said, the Supreme Court is U.S. Supreme Court already looking at a Mississippi case. Can you remind us briefly of which one that is?
Sure. So the case is called Dobbs. Dobbs is out of Mississippi. It involves a law banning abortion at 15 weeks, which is the point at which Mississippi says fetal pain is possible. Scientists don't mostly agree with that, but what's important is that 15 weeks is well before fetal viability, the point at which survival is possible outside of the womb, and that usually falls around the 24th week. So in order to uphold Mississippi's law, which is what people expect the Supreme Court to do, the court will either have to invalidate all of Roe v. Wade or invalidate part of Roe v. Wade, because Roe says there's a right to choose abortion until fetal viability.
And what's happening in Texas, is that going to affect it in any way?
It doesn't have to, no. It's more of a harbinger than it is something that would control the outcome of the Mississippi case.
And just so we're clear, too, by the way, that Texas law, basically the lawsuits are against the person performing the abortion, but nothing against the person, the woman receiving the abortion, right?
That's right. It's not just the person performing the abortion, though. It's anyone who's considered to have aided or abetted, which is, I think, a deliberately ambiguous term. That we know include, and that's true, by the way, in Florida as well, that aiding or abetting liability is created. So we know that it would clearly include things like paying for an abortion through insurance, but it might also include anything from, helping someone heal after an abortion to driving someone to an abortion. It could extend to friends, family, people from out of state, people who are driving Ubers to abortion clinics. So it's not just people performing abortions. It's a much larger universe of folks.
Which goes to that part, which is aiding and abetting. I wanted to just come back one more time because I wanted to be clear on this. Why we're not seeing more groups or people in favor of abortion restrictions filing lawsuits?
Well, I think it's because after Texas went into effect, what people realized, which I don't know if Florida lawmakers have realized, is that there's a Supreme Court case that's likely going to open the door to many more abortion restrictions that's going to be decided by the summer of 2022,
That's the
that quite
Mississippi one.
possibly could overturn, exactly, that
Okay.
quite possibly could overturn Roe. And so in the short term, when someone files a lawsuit, that's going to create an opportunity to bring up a constitution that's more likely to be effective, the law from going into effect. So it's almost better from the standpoint of people who pass these laws to have there be no lawsuits and to have abortion providers be scared to get sued and just simply stop providing abortions. So the incentive structure at the moment in Texas is that people opposed to abortion want to have fewer lawsuits, and people who are in favor of abortion want to have more, which just goes to show you that if Florida passes this law, it's a Pandora's box, and we're not going to know ahead of time what the consequences are going to be.
It is a fascinating story, and just we have to wait and see. There's so much that can happen, as you said, and we have to wait and see how this all plays out. Mary Ziegler, law professor at Florida State University, author of Abortion and the Law in America. Professor Ziegler, thank you so much for helping us try to understand this.
My pleasure, anytime.
All right. And of course, stay tuned. We will keep following the story. Again, the legislative session starts in January. Well, still to come. What if Alice fell down the wrong rabbit hole and ended up in our world? A new art exhibit tells that story. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Remember the tale of Alice in Wonderland? She falls down the rabbit hole and finds herself in an extraordinary world. Okay, so imagine this. Alice falls through a different rabbit hole. Instead of a fantasy underworld, she ends up in our world today. And what does she see? She sees a world on fire, social unrest, disease, division. Well, that's Alice in Dystopia. The story is told in a new short film being showcased at the IPC Art Space in Little Haiti. The exhibit titled Tales of Transformation explores classic stories and how they can serve us in times of crisis. We're speaking with two artists participating in this exhibit. I want to bring in the first one, Jeannie Jaffe. Jeannie, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. Can you hear me?
Absolutely.
Okay,
You know,
great.
Jeannie, first of all, love the film and because I love the style, which we'll talk about here in a second, but what is it about that story, Alice in Wonderland, that intrigued you so much and you wanted to go down that rabbit hole?
Well, the story itself, I was really intrigued by the caterpillar asking her who she was. Who are you? And I think that's a question everybody asks themselves, particularly in transitional times. So the fact of having to re-examine who we really are, what we value, where we're from, and what world we're in is really important. And then when 2020 happened, I imagined what would they do, Alice and the Rabbit, if they ended up in the world we're in today? So that's the generation of the idea.
Yeah. And again, it's titled Alice in Dystopia, and it's a stop motion film. And right. I mean, I haven't seen one of those in a while. You use puppets and marionettes. And again, not this is not mainstream filmmaking. This is something that was very popular many, many years ago. But why do you want to go that way?
I usually work in sculpture and installation, and that takes up a huge amount of space. And it's also hard to just tell stories that way. So this allowed me to actually scale down the sculpture that I made and tell a story in a world that I could create and really control the entire experience in the entire world. It was something where a totally different possibility existed. And I love the old stop motion animation. I think they're beautiful because they aren't dependent on high technology.
Yeah.
And so they also go back to childhood memories in a way, or even when children are reading stories, how their imagination might imagine them and picture them.
Jeannie, you started this project before 2020, before the pandemic, but how did the pandemic shape the story that you told?
Well, originally it was just going to be about this question of how do you determine who you are and what your value systems are? And then when 2020 happened, it became a question I think the whole world needs to ask. I think we're in a period of time where the value systems we've been living by have really created so many problems on so many levels, both in terms of the of nature and the ecology and social and political and economic problems. And I think it's a critical turning point to begin to ask, what do we really value and what is important that will make a world worth living in for everybody?
And I love that question, asking that question, who are you? And for Jeannie, for you, what does that question mean to you and how you try to answer it?
It means I've spent a lot of time thinking about that because I think that so much of identity is based on what the culture tells us we need to be or what the social conditioning is. And that's not really freedom in a way. And it's also not necessarily the best possibilities for life. In other words, if in our culture frequently there's a attempt to accumulate a lot and to be successful and at other people's expense and things like that. And to me, life really is much more of an internal kind of quest and exploration of the things that you love, that bring wonder into the world, that are joyful, that are more community, build community more. And so that question of who we are right now became really important in 2020, because I think it's something that this having slowed down allowed a lot of people to begin to question their values.
You know, and the part of the film for me that really hit was obviously, I mean, Alice and the rabbit go through the rabbit hole and then they find themselves in our world. And it's just the things they see. And I mean, I guess if you arrive in this world, if you're coming from another time in another world and you arrive on planet Earth in 2020, yeah, you'd probably see the fires and the floods and so much. Not to say that the world is completely on fire, but there are a lot of bad thing, negative things. I mean, what was going through your mind as you're thinking about what that world would be that Alice would encounter?
Well, I was just trying to think of what is going on in terms of how much loss there is in terms of for so many people in terms of fire, in terms of floods, political situations. There's a scene in there where there are boots, army boots, military boots. There's just so much going on. And then I tried to imagine how would they resolve this? What would they decide to do with all this? So the film in the end ends up with the quote from Kierkegaard, Fear and Trembling, that hope is the passion for the possible. And so in the film, in a dream, she has a spirit come to her and say, you will know who you are by what you choose to do. So she has to choose how to navigate this world. So it's not just what's going on, but it's how do we change it and alter it at this point.
Such a fascinating way to take a very popular old fable and give it that modern twist. I'm speaking with Jeannie Joffe, one of the artists exhibiting her work at the IPC Art Space in Little Haiti. The exhibit is titled Tales of Transformation. It explores classic tales like Alice in Wonderland and how those stories can serve us now when we think about the different crises that we experience. Jeannie's stop-motion film tells that story again through the tale of Alice in Wonderland. By the way, it's open to the public now until October 9th, and you can find some photos and more information about the exhibit on our social media at WLRN Sundial. I want to turn now over to the other artist who's going to be there as well, Molly McCreevy. She is the artist showing her stuff at the IPC Art Space in Little Haiti. Molly, thank you so much for the time. Your art explores the classic German tale of Faust. Remind us of that story. Why'd you pick that?
The story is about the man who sold his soul to the devil for worldly possessions and metaphysical knowledge. And in some versions of the story, he gets dragged down to hell. And in other versions, there's some redemption there. And it's an old German folktale from the 1500s. And I chose it because I've always loved folktales. I was a literature student. I also studied creative writing at FIU. So I always gravitated towards fairy tales and folktales. And I like this one because there's so much, people recognize it, the plot, and also, there's so much that you can do with it.
One of the things that's interesting is that folktales usually have a lesson.
Right.
What's the lesson here? What are you trying to tell us?
Right. Well, the lesson here is I took this Faust story and modernized it in the way that we have a Faustian bargain with consumerism. Everybody spends. We know the cost of it. We know that it's destructive to the environment. We know that it hurts people on the other side of the world who are working for pennies a day. But yet, most people I know, we can't stop consuming. We can't stop purchasing on Amazon. We can't stop going to the mall and buying things that we don't need. And in a way, that's a Faustian bargain because we can, we see it now with the pollution in the oceans. And so the moral is, what are we going to do with this Faustian bargain that we made with consumerism?
That idea that, I can't be happy unless I have more and more and more and more.
And you're never satisfied, right?
Right. You're also working on a stop motion film for this story. Where are you right now in the process?
Well, in the process right now, I have the puppets made and I'm working on the storyboards for it. So wanted to carefully plan it out before I start filming because stop motion is so labor intensive. So right now, getting the sets together, the puppets, and getting the story together.
What is it about stop motion? Just as I asked Jeannie, what is it about that for you that's a great storytelling platform?
Well, stop motion is beautiful in its own way. Because it breaks up the action, you get this uncanny motion, and it takes you into a different world, makes it more mysterious, makes you maybe a little bit uncomfortable to, have motion that doesn't really move the way that we move in every day. And I think it has a long history of being dark, and I tend to do that in my writings.
Yeah. I was thinking about stop motion, and I was just thinking about so many of the different movies or shows I grew up watching, as an old Gen Xer. And, first of all, I remind people, listen, the original Star Wars movies use stop motion in some of their monsters, but it is a taxing, type of a style. because it could take a while. It's one, you position a character, you stop, take that shot, position again. It can take a while.
One at a time. Yeah. Yes. It takes a long time. Jeannie filmed, I think in the studio here, I think she filmed for over a year. And we, you know, would work a day and we would, what Jeannie would have, what, 2 minutes of,
frequently hours of working could actually end up with 2 minutes maximum of a good film.
Yeah. You could spend a whole day and you'll get maybe a minute and a half of film.
Not even sometimes.
Right. And her film, by the way, is under 10 minutes. So altogether, I wanted to know, because besides the film that you're working on, you do have pieces that are on exhibit at the IPC Art Space in Little Haiti. Tell us a little bit about those.
Well, they are related to alchemy. Faust was an alchemist in many of the stories. And so what I did is I took photographs of like serene meditative spaces. And then after I print the photograph, then I draw a pen and ink with like fountain pen and ink, medieval symbolism taken from different manuscripts, mostly alchemy manuscripts. So I combine those two so that, you know, the symbolism is still relevant, even though it looks old. So someone can sort of, in a meditative mood, still use those ancient symbols to help you in transformation. Alchemy has different steps, and they're usually in the same order, depends on, you know, what manuscript you see. But different steps can also be seen as stages of transformation, personal transformation. So you see, like, there's one stage where it's symbolized by a man and a woman coming together, and then there's a baby. And what that really means is the opposites of yourself, your shadow self, your regular, your self that you put on a daily, and you combine them together to create a new self.
Yeah.
So alchemy has a lot of those steps in it.
And Molly, how many pieces do you have altogether?
I believe there are, at the show, I think that there's six or seven. I have some newer ones too.
Again, I'm talking with Molly McCreevy. She's one of the artists exhibiting her work at the IPC Art Space in Little Haiti. The exhibit is titled Tales of Transformation. It explores classic tales and how those stories can serve us in a time of crisis. We also were talking with Jeannie Joffe, who's showcasing her work at the exhibit at the same time. And Jeannie, I want to bring you back in here. The Art Space is hosting these free workshops on Saturdays for kids, right?
Yes, we are. We have in the first space, we're doing different kinds of workshops. We're doing some workshops with shadow puppets, with some children between 8 and about 15. And we're having them tell their stories and make shadow puppets and then present their stories. And we're doing a second kind of workshop coming up with Breakthrough, where we're bringing these kids in. They're also in the section with Alice. They're 9-foot sculptures there. And the children are small. So they're going to come in and talk to us about their experience in that kind of a space and in front of those kind of characters that are large. And that way we get to understand their perspective on the world rather than us telling them what these things mean. And so we're doing two different kinds of workshops there.
You know, I'm really curious, Jeannie, as well, is you know, kids today have, you know, all this technology and they could watch anything they want at any point. But how have they reacted or what kind of reaction have you gotten from young people on your film? Again, because it's done in an older format.
That's a good question. Unfortunately, we haven't had a lot of children in there yet. The kids that come in seem to be very absorbed in it, partly because it goes into another world. But I think more than that, they have a reaction to these huge sculptures because they're frightening a little bit to them because of their scale and because it makes them small. So in a way, it puts them in the world Alice was in, where Alice became small and the world became big. So it reverses the normal situation. And I think that's what that thing in the real world, that uncanny experience for them in the real world, seems to be more what they're responding to than just the film itself.
Yeah. Molly, what kind of response are you getting from folks?
Oh, I'm getting a pretty positive response. There were a few children who saw a sketch or drawing for the devil, and they were both, you know, obsessed and terrified by it at the same time. And I also have the Faust and Gretchen and the boy marionettes. So, you know, I think children really love marionettes. I let them touch them and move them. And, you know, it's just a miniature person. It's fascinating.
Yeah. Molly, what do you want people to take from this exhibit?
Well, I want people to think about the issues that are current today, but also I want them to be empowered by stories to do something about it, to change yourself interior in the interior and then bring it out and try to change the world with it. So using stories as a way to transform yourself, to go out and do something and feel empowered about, you know, with what's going on today.
Yeah. And Jeannie, what about you? What do you want people to take away?
They're very similar, and I think that's why we're in this show. But the other thing I would really like people to think about, especially adults, is how the stories we're told condition how we see the world, and that we have the right, and in a sense, we even have the responsibility to rethink what we've been conditioned and what we've been told so that we can recreate the world that we want and not have to just continue with how things have already been structured and how and with the stories that we've been told and tell ourselves and tell our children.
Yeah.
So in a way, it's similar.
Jeannie Jaffe and Molly McCreevy, they are the two artists that are part of the Tales of Transformation exhibit at the IPC Art Space in Little Haiti. It's open now to the public until October 9th.
Hello.
Jeannie, okay. Molly, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank
we
you.
Really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
All right. And by the way, we have photos and more information about this exhibit on our social media. Check them out. They are really, really beautiful. It's at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, Sunfest has been shelved for 2 years. Organizers have a plan for a big return in 2022. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have you made your way up to Sunfest in Palm Beach County in the past? The four-day outdoor festival is one of the biggest in the region. The event's going to celebrate its 40th anniversary next year, but these last 2 years, well, it had to cancel a lot of events because of the pandemic. Now, the lead-up to next year's event began this year with a series of smaller shows, and one of them is actually taking place tonight. It's going to be called Clematis by Night, with performances starting at 6 p.m. Most of the tickets are free, by the way, except for the VIPs. Joining us now, WLRN Palm Beach County reporter Wilkin Brutus. Wilkin, when's the last time you were at Sunfest?
It's been about 2 years now, Louis. The pandemic certainly changed everything.
Do you remember your favorite show there, by the way?
I don't really have a specific favorite show, mainly because there are multiple stages. And so for me, I've had several opportunities to explore different types of talent. So it ranges from hip hop to funk to rock. And so I don't really have a favorite act. I do have favorite genres that I've experienced there.
All right. Well, I'll just tell you right now. So my favorite goes back to 1999, and I got to see Hootie and the Blowfish. All right.
Wow.
So that's that. I had to say that because, you know, for those of you who, for Hootie fans out there, you remember that was a great show. You know what? I mean, as you said, the pandemic has pushed this off until 2022. When did officials make that decision, though, like that they were going to shut it down until then?
I would say the officials made that decision earlier this year in January, actually, mainly because of the pandemic. And it's one of those reasons, one of the harder decisions to make, because a lot of music fans were looking forward to the to that actual festival like any other year. But yeah, officials, Sunfest officials, not city officials, Sunfest officials made that decision earlier this year.
All right. I don't want to make the assumption that everybody knows what Sunfest is. If you've lived in South Florida for a while, you've heard of it. But just remind people, like, it's a 4-day event, but remind people of what, you know, what that experience is.
Well, Sunfest is an annual music and art festival that stretches alongside the Intercoastal Waterway in West Palm Beach. And the festival has been around since the early 80s. I mean, you've certainly dated yourself earlier. the festival goes on for about 4 days. There's food and art vendors, multiple stage setups. And we're talking about tens of thousands of people jamming to a variety of musical styles, like I said earlier, from up and coming local acts to international performers. And legends have performed at Sunfest, from James Brown, Bob Dylan, to contemporary performers like Alabama Shakes and Kendrick Lamar. And just to go back to your previous question, COVID-19 had deeply affected the touring logistics for many notable musicians.
Yeah.
And the sentiment toward large music gatherings was much lower earlier this year than it is now. And so that's one major reason why Sunfest officials had canceled this year's Sunfest.
Is saying 1999 dating myself that much? Come on.
Yep.
It's not that bad.
It's not that bad.
So organizers this year, what they're doing is they're having smaller events. Like I said, the Clematis by Night, and they're spreading them out. And there's one tonight, and they had one back in April. How are they setting these up, and what are they doing? Is it just a build up to next year?
Yeah, just to add some clarification to the listeners here, the city of West Palm Beach owns a music series called Clematis by Night, which is held on Clematis Street at that specific downtown waterfront. And so city officials of that event decided to partner with Sunfest, which is owned by a nonprofit. And they both partnered for a mini music festival, which essentially aims to produce enthusiasm for next year's Sunfest. It's sort of like an early preview of sorts, and it includes past Sunfest Battle of the Bands contest winners, which were up and coming local bands who had competed for a chance to play at Sunfest. So the lineup bands for Sunfest includes local South Florida bands, Citizen Badger, Kim Rottery. There's a another performer called Tabitha Meeks. She's known for her piano solos. So there's some South Florida acts for this specific evening.
That's the one for tonight. As I mentioned, the tickets I understand are free, except unless you're at a VIP. And how many more of these are they going to be doing this year?
So far, there are about 4 total shows in the series. This is the second one, so I'm assuming 2 more.
Are there any COVID precautions? What are they doing?
For this specific event, the regular encouragement for masking and social distancing are in place, but there are no sort of vaccination card requirements of sorts. It's just basically masking, social distancing, and that's essentially the encouragement that city officials are giving out publicly.
Have they talked about, I mean, look, this event brings over 100,000 people. I mean, the Sunfest will bring over 100,000 people to that area. And that's just, I mean, a lot of people in this one little area for the festival. Have they started talking about next year? We don't know what's going to happen, but, you know, when it comes to vaccinations, masks, are they discussing that now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a huge, let's look at the economy to that extent. It Sunfest is huge. The economic impact of Sunfest is strong because many small businesses in and around Sunfest usually benefit from the extra foot traffic. And so earlier this week, I spoke to the executive director of Sunfest, Paul Jameson, who said they're planning on a regular outdoor Sunfest with COVID-related adjustments, but that the organizers are still working out the details because you never know the state of the pandemic next year. But people can expect to see the festival in full swing next year with your favorite bands and musicians. But so far, no formal safety-related plans have moved forward just yet.
And what kind of things are they planning for 2022? I'd imagine, because that's the 40th anniversary. That's going to be 40 years.
Yes, the 40th anniversary. I'm pretty sure that the touring logistics will be much better improved for next year, which will allow Sunfest organizers to get some of the notable musicians and bands into West Palm Beach. And that was one of the main concerns for this year, actually. And so there is some increased enthusiasm, mainly because a lot of people are far more comfortable attending large gatherings. And that includes musicians feeling a bit more comfortable performing at these larger gatherings. And so there is this expectation to launch Sunfest as if it was just Sunfest from prior years, but with obvious COVID-related protocols to make sure that they maximize the safety requirements.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in your conversations with the organizers and or with the city, I wonder, like, you know, how much they've lost not having this. And I know that a lot of things, especially last year, were shut down, but, you know, like how hard a hit that had to be economically.
Oh, it's been a huge hit, again, especially for the small businesses who benefit from the foot traffic from Sunfest. It's a four-day extravaganza where people leave the actual multi-stage area and then venture off to the rest of the city. And so that means venturing off to the 500 block of Clematis Street. That means venturing off to streets that are not commonly ventured off into. And so it's a huge economic boost for local businesses. And the fact that it's been gone for 2 years, the impact has certainly shown. There are some businesses that aren't there anymore because of the pandemic. And so there is this huge expectation that next year when Sunfest does arrive, which is why they're boosting up enthusiasm now, that these small businesses will certainly benefit from that foot traffic.
And like you said, you know, one of the really great things about Sunfest is that, you know, you do have these big names that come in, and then, but you have to get there. What I would say to people, if you've never been, you have to get there early, because you're going to have those local or unknown artists opening for the big names, and that's when you're going to meet the stars of tomorrow. Is in those opportunities. I wish I could tell you who was opening for Hootie at the time, but, you know, I hope that they had a successful career. I was just thinking about Hootie and the Blowfish, so it doesn't matter. And that was a great year, by the way, 1999, so I'll leave it at that.
1999 is definitely a classic year for music, for sure.
All right. Wes, Palm Beach County, WLRN Palm Beach County reporter Wilkin Brutus, thank you so much, Wilkin.
Thank you, Lewis.
All right, again, Sunfest coming back in 2022. And you know what? We'll let you know all about it when it's finally getting here. We'll talk with the organizers about what we can expect for that new festival. By the way, we're listening to Little Hootie and the Blowfish. They are not going to be at the festival next year, just so you know that. This is back from 1999. Well, that's our program for this Thursday, September 23rd. Coming up next week on Sundial, we're going to meet the new police chief in Fort Lauderdale, joining the force from Pittsburgh, Larry Scarrotto. He takes over an embattled department that's facing a lot of controversy for its handling of last year's Black Lives Matter protests. And, of course, a number of officers who refused to get vaccinated. We're going to talk about all that. And, by the way, if you have a question for the police chief, you can post it on our Facebook at WLRN Sundial. We'll get those questions to him. Carbon monoxide poisoning, really deadly for humans and animals, and we usually think of it as an indoor problem, but it could be an outdoor problem as well. There's a risk, especially if you're a boater. One of the top five causes of boating-related deaths. So we're going to hear from a health expert about basic boating safety. Just really simple things, but it can make a big difference. Don't forget, by the way, for this month, the Sundial Book Club, we are reading Infinite Country by author Patricia Engel. It's an amazing story. It's about a family that's split between the U.S. and Colombia, and how this mixed status family is pursuing their dreams, and that weight of being undocumented in America, what it could mean to families. We're going to be talking with her tomorrow in a taped interview. If you have been reading the book, you got questions for her, find us on Facebook. Just look up Sundial Book Club. Ask to join if you're not a member. It's free. We'd love to have you. Post your questions there. I'm going to be asking her those questions tomorrow. We'll be playing the interview next week. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful Friday. Have a great weekend. Stay safe. As always, please be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.